Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
We have two guests this week. They come from different races. For many years, they were direct competitors as the editorial page editors for the two Detroit newspapers, and they have very different political views. They met in 2008, and today are close friends, and they respect each other, even though they disagree on most every issue and their solutions. A current day, George Will and Juan Williams, their names, Nolan Finley and Stephen Henderson. And I'm Jack Quisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Quisula, and we're with a modern day Juan Williams, George Will. We got Stephen Henderson and Nolan Finley. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
They are the co-host of One Detroit on Detroit Public TV, amongst a whole lot of other things. Okay, let's start.
Thanks, Nolan. Jack.
Nolan, talk about your mom and your dad and growing up in Kentucky.
Well, we were back and forth from Kentucky to Detroit. My dad, you know, our family's fairly typical, coming out of the Appalachian foothills. You know, both of them raised very poor, raised during the Depression. Neither one of them had an eighth grade education or any further than that. And they, you know, tried to do a lot of things. Came up here, started working in factories, as did my mother, and, you know, had very modest lives. So, you know, working class lives, and, you know, did the best they could. And, you know, I was the beneficiary from there. Of their both their work ethic and their hard work, the good people, simple people, you know, they had people of tremendous faith and very hardworking.
Stephen, likewise, yeah. Your mom, your dad, and your youth in Detroit.
Yeah, so my family, my mom's family, moved to Detroit in 1957. My grandfather, her father, was a close aide to Walter Reuther, who was the founder of the UAW. He brought my grandfather to Detroit to help the union connect better with the growing black political class in the city at that time. And so my grandfather comes and helps organize in the city, helps push along the maturity of the black political class in the city, becomes instrumental in the election of Coleman Young as the first black mayor in 1973. And I'm born in 1970. And so I'm born into this moment in the city and in black politics. The civil rights movement was huge here in Detroit as well. My grandfather had a lot to do with that. And my family was sort of not just a beneficiary of the things that were changing at that time and the opportunity in the union and in politics, but also a force behind the change and making that change for other Detroiters. My dad's family, my dad moved to Detroit from Mississippi in the early 1960s. After having served in the Korean War and gone home to a Mississippi where Jim Crow was still the law and opportunity was not something he was going to experience. He comes to Detroit really to experience better things, to get opportunities that weren't available to him. So on both sides of my family, that moment leading up to 1970 is really formidable in shaping what my experiences were and then shaping the way I see the world.
with Nolan Finley and Stephen Henderson in 2012. Nolan was inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame. Nolan, where'd you get your love for writing?
You know, it was about all I could do when I was a kid. I mean, when I was in high school, I was not a very good student. I think I graduated high school with a 1.7 grade point average. And, you know, what was the poster child for wasted potential? And I had a sixth grade teacher who said, well, you know, you can't do much else, but you're not a bad writer. Why don't you, you know, join the newspaper? And so I did that. When I got to high school, I was on the newspaper and benefited from a very wonderful teacher. And, you know, it right away sort of got under my skin. It wasn't the writing so much as it was this intense curiosity. I wanted to know what was going on, what was happening, and why. And, you know, I just always have wanted to know why. And so, you know, I was driven first by a love of reporting, like to talk to people, like to ask questions, like to get to the bottom of things. And so I came into journalism through that route. Never wanted to write the great American novel. I just wanted to be the person who knew what was happening, when, and why.
In 2014, Stephen Henderson won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Stephen, what do all great writers have in common?
I think Nolan actually hit on it. Curiosity. I think the idea of wanting to know why, wanting to know how things work and why they're true is the thing that drives almost all of us. That's the same thing that attracted me to being a writer and to being a journalist. I used to sit and as a kid, I would watch the evening news and then sit and type up a summary of what I'd seen and a list of questions about the stories that I saw and things that I didn't understand or didn't know. And then I'd take that list of questions and then go to the library and try to look them up and try to figure out what was true. I think every great writer and especially every great journalist has that just innate drive to figure out things, to kind of take things apart and see where the parts go back together and why. For me, there was never a question about whether my work would include that, because again, it was the thing that I was most interested in and the best at. I came to journalism because I thought it was the way to do it every day. It was the way to be able to return to that questioning, to ask those questions and get answers every day. That newspaper deadline for me had the call of a drug almost. That daily feeding of my curiosity and of the information needs of my community.
We're talking to Stephen Henderson, Nolan Finley. When we come back, we're going to ask him, each of them, to describe their basic views and their beliefs. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Nolan Finley, Stephen Henderson. Disagree on most everything. We're competitors for many years, but they respect each other and they're great friends. Steve, you go first. How do you describe your basic views and beliefs?
So I always start with the idea that, you know, that I love this country and I love its ideals. I think there's no greater fortune bestowed on anyone than being born an American, because of the promise that holds for your life. At the same time, I think we have never ever lived up to those ideals and that potential. And for people who look like me, that has meant centuries of tragedy. That has meant centuries of misfortune and cruelty bestowed upon us, as well as that opportunity. And I kind of approach everything from the idea that we've got to push America to fulfill those promises, primarily to those who have not been rewarded with those fulfillments. I think that is the master narrative of our country over the last 240 some years. And I think it is the thing that calls to us as Americans to fix. And so I call myself a progressive in the very classic sense that I believe that that there must be change, that there must be radical change in order to make America honor her promises to all Americans. And I call myself, a liberal in the sense that I believe all of those fulfillments, all of those promises should be available to everyone. I believe that that we should not be in a position of denying those privileges, those rights to anyone, and that is the main call and task of our role as Americans in this country.
Nolan, how do you describe your basic views and beliefs?
Please. Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Jack, because that's the sort of foundational step in the civility project that Steve and I are doing, trying to figure out the values and experiences of the people you're conversing with or you may disagree with. You know, our sort of the thing we say is that, you know, everybody comes to their opinions in the same way. They take the facts, they take the data, and apply their own values and experiences to it and come up with a viewpoint. And if their viewpoint is different than yours, doesn't make them evil, stupid, or that they hate America. And so that's a great question, and it's a question we always ask people. I'm a conservative also, as in the classic sense. To me, conservative means conserving the values and institutions that have made the country great. I believe change should be deliberate, well thought out, and slow. I also believe in the power of the individual and the empowerment of the individual. Very much a civil libertarian, I believe that the Constitution it carves out a very large space for the individuals to stand safe from the power of the government. And I do believe that we get our rights. Our rights are natural; they're not bestowed by the government, and that the government shouldn't encroach on those rights. I believe when individuals are left to make their own decisions and guide their own life and are dependent mostly on themselves, they do best. And that comes from, you know, as I said, growing up in a rather meager background with parents who worked extraordinarily hard. So, you know, I believe in hard work. I believe in education. That I think I would be nowhere today had I not had an opportunity for an education, and didn't come easy. I mean, I started working full time in a factory when I was a junior in high school. Check out of high school at 2:30, check in the factory at 4, and work right beside my mother in that factory. And you know, that sort of belief that if you work hard enough, you can you can rise and you can succeed. It's not guaranteed. It certainly doesn't happen for everyone. But, you know, I'll take, you know, my motto from the name of your show, anything is possible. I believe in this country. And I do understand it's harder for some people, and that there have been folks in our society, races in our society, who haven't had, even with hard work, you know, the same opportunities that I've had. But, you know, I think we're always striving to make it work, and we got to keep striving to make it work.
All right. The disdain, the vitriol, the hatred today between the two sides, the two of you could be the poster boys for the two sides. You're so different. You met in 2008. You disagree on most everything. You competed, okay, with the two newspapers. How is it you like each other, you're close friends, and you respect each other?
You know, you build that, and you build it with a willingness. And, you know, you start with the things you have in common. Steve and I, you know, both like to drink bourbon, and we drank a whole lot of bourbon together before we ever got around to talking about the tough stuff. And it's got to be intentional. And you know, if you go back and look at last Thursday's One Detroit show, you'll see us talking about some, you know, some issues we disagree very passionately on, and yet you'll see and feel, I think, the cordiality in the discussion. It is possible, and if you take a chance, and if you know to reach across that divide and get to know somebody as a person before you start judging them for your politics. We know all about the hate. We get it every day, and it is good to be able to talk to somebody who has different views in a civil manner. You can learn from that. And I've always felt in our conversations, I know I'm never going to bring Steve into the light, but that's not my goal. My goal is to challenge my own opinions and perhaps learn something in the process.
Another thing the two of you have in common is you both have a face for TV. As evidence by the fact that you host One Detroit.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
Yeah, but not the hairline, Jack.
All right. Okay. You guys, for the last year and a half or so, have spent a lot of time on this civility project. What is it, Steve? And what can we, the listeners, do in our own little way?
Yeah, so I think the Civility Project is best described as Nolan and I making an effort to take this 12 years of experience we have trying to carve out a workable, manageable space between the two of us and share that with other people. Share with other people how to do that, how to actually be friends and genuine friends with somebody that you fundamentally disagree with, somebody who you just cannot see eye to eye with on almost any political or social issue. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do is to identify, you know, the principles that guide that relationship, the things that we've learned over that time that make it work, and try to encourage other people to do the same things. One of them is listening, the art of listening, actually listening to someone that you disagree with. I say all the time that I think for a lot of us, the definition of listening means not talking, right? If I'm not talking, I must be listening to you. But that's not always the case. A lot of times we're not talking, but we're not really listening to the person across from us. We're not really trying to figure out what they're trying to say, why they might believe that, and try to have some understanding of where they're coming from. That's a key part of the relationship between Nolan and I. Another big part of it is committing to the idea that we're going to have disagreements. We're going to have passionate disagreements. We may even have spirited arguments. I mean, we may even get into fights. But at the end of it, neither one of us ever gets up and says, I am done with that guy. I am not going to come back to this space. I am not going to come back to this conversation. Each time we say, well, I'll be back the next time. And the relationship itself is more important and is more intact than this argument, this disagreement, is significant. That's really hard to do. And so much of our world today encourages us to act the opposite way, right? Social media encourages us to block people who we don't agree with or to savage them in front of other people. The 24-hour cable news environment thrives on definitive conflict that ends a discussion or a relationship. I think what one of the things we really tried to do is push all that stuff away and to say, we're not going to behave that way. We can have disagreements. We can have arguments. We can have fights. But it never rises to the level of destroying the respect that builds the relationship between the two of us.
And if we were allowed that to happen, Jack, I think both of us would miss the debate. We'd miss the friction. We'd miss sort of that energy that comes from a good, healthy argument. You know, there's no hatred in the conversation, but there is passion in the conversation. And I think that's what we should strive toward.
We're talking to Nolan Finley, Stephen Henderson, and I'm Jack Pasulin. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasulin. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to two men. Nolan Finley, since 2000, has been the editorial page director of the Detroit News. He's been there since 1976. They're going to put a statue of him up there. I don't know how long it'll stay up there. All right. And from 2009 to 2017, Stephen was editorial page director of the Detroit Free Press. Nolan, what do the liberals / progressives most miss or that you disagree with?
Well, I would think this idea of sacrificing the rights of the individual, turning the rights of the individual into collective rights, and sacrificing the ability to be an individual and to be independent and sort of walk in a different direction. This call to groupthink is, in my mind, a very dangerous trend. But I think what they miss is the notion that empowering an individual is much better than taking over an individual's life and trying to take care of that person.
Stephen, conversely, what do conservatives miss or that you most disagree with?
Well, I mean, I first would say that this idea of the individual is very powerful and important, but it's also just a falsity in American history. Groupthink is what drove slavery, right? They didn't say you as an individual don't have these rights. They said you as a class, because you are African Americans, don't have these rights. Jim Crow was a classic example of groupthink. You may not eat in this restaurant. You may not stay in this hotel. You may not have this job because you are part of this group. And so then to turn around and say that it's the power of the individual that matters is a little hypocritical. The truth is that what we need are respect for all of the groups that make up America and the end of the negative groupthink that conservatives invented. This country was founded on the idea of that groupthink that Nolan's talking about. It's not that liberals or progressives don't value the power of the individual. It's that for eternity in this country, as a group, so many of us have been locked out and denied that individuality. If we could on our own push back against those things, that would be great. The truth is, what we need is the group yoke off of our backs. And that is what I think progressive politics is about. It is, in this country, really defined as the elimination of those institutions that founded and carry on the inequalities that we live with every day.
Nolan, on August 1st, you wrote an article, Fight Racism with Literacy, where you highlight, profile Pam Good's Beyond Basics.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want your listeners to take away from that article?
Well, I mean, I guess wanted people to start focusing. I mean, you've got a lot of conversation out here about fighting systemic racism and fighting inequity and a lot of protests going on. And not much conversation about putting flesh on that plea, on that call. I guess I wanted us to start heading in a direction where we're actually doing something. And my belief is that economic empowerment is the best remedy, or one of the best remedies to what's wrong here. We've got a chronic underclass in this country that we've allowed to develop. And the only way, I believe, to lift that underclass and put everybody closer to a equal footing is through education. It certainly worked for me in coming out of one of the poorest regions in the country. But before you can get a good education, you've got to teach kids to read. And we've allowed so many generations of students to underperform in reading and thus underperform overall in education. And the Beyond Basics program, holds the promise of being able to very quickly bring a child to grade level reading so that that child can move beyond that and learn other subjects. You imagine what a difference it would make in the Detroit public schools if everybody who sat down to take a standardized test could actually read and comprehend the test. So I believe that first step to helping people rise and to combating inequity is a equal education. We don't have that in this state, in this region. An equal education, and a good education starts with reading. You go from there. With a good education, there are opportunities in our economy that you can exploit, and you're not as helpless, and you're not as likely to be a victim if you have sort of that empowerment that education and a good job and a good income bring.
We're talking to Stephen Henderson, Nolan Finley, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're with Nolan Finley, Stephen Henderson. Stephen, if I'm blind to words in today's economy, I ain't got a prayer.
Yeah.
If I learned to read, somebody's taught me how to fish. Okay. A couple weeks ago, I had a Ugandan guy, lives in Lansing, C.J. Jackson Kogari. Very poor rural upbringing. Somehow he got to America. Terrific person. Goes back to Uganda 20 years ago and sees the devastation of AIDS, HIV, where tens of thousands of kids are orphans. It's not only that they don't have a dad, they don't have a mom. Very poor. And these older women become grandmothers. They're not even related to the kids, but get 15,000 of these grandmothers, angels, helping about 80,000 kids that they're not related to. And he set up a series of schools. Some of these kids are walking, honest to God, 20 miles each way to school each day. We got some of these schools in our city, 50% unemployment each day. Forget that we ain't got dads in the house. Why don't the grandmothers and the moms demand the kid to go to school like your mom did? How do we get them to do that?
Well, I mean, I think, so first of all, I would say in answer to what Nolan's saying, I mean, there's not a lot that he said there that I disagree with. And I was for a long time a board member of Beyond Basics and tried really hard to get it adopted more widely in Detroit public schools. One of the obstacles to that is cost. It's a very expensive approach. You are talking about very intensive reading instruction for a long period of the day for every kid. We don't fund schools that way in the city of Detroit. There's not money to do that. But to your question about family structure and why we see the things that we do in African American communities, where do you imagine that Black people learned to devalue each other. Where do you imagine that the idea of dysfunction, of non-intact family units comes from? Black people didn't bring this with them from Africa. This is a taught behavior. This is a culture that is shaped inexorably by four centuries of slavery and then discrimination. And it has only been, within my lifetime that there is any notion of actual equality on the books I'm talking about. It's going to take a much longer time to repair the things that got broken over that previous four centuries. It is not that African Americans don't value each other inherently. It is that we are trapped in a nation that has devalued us from the beginning, and that at some point a lot of that becomes internalized, and it becomes really difficult to turn around and to say we will do differently. If you look at the progress that's been made over the last 50 years, since 55 years, since the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, you're starting to see how things can be better, how people can make tremendous progress unfettered by legal discrimination. Our problem now is that we've still got all these institutions that are just imbued with discrimination, the banking system, the housing system in this country, the food system in this country are all baked into these notions of gross inequality. And it's just going to take a long time to get to the point where we can say a kid who's born here in the city of Detroit to a family on the east side of the city has exactly the same opportunity to become whatever he or she wants to be as a kid born in the same economic circumstances, but in a white community. We're not there. And so it's hard, I think, to make apples to apples comparisons or to say, we think those things should be different now. We'll get there, but it's going to be a long time.
If Pam Good was on this Zoom call, she would demand to say, hey, yes, it's on average $3,000 per kid.
Yeah.
But we do that once, we've transformed.
Right.
And then another Stephen Henderson, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're in an environment, Jack, now where people, you know, you got corporations all over America feeling pressure to do something, to write checks. Why not? I mean, it's $130 million. That's a lot of money. But you think about all the money we pour in to try to reform education in Detroit and try to improve those test scores. And it doesn't work year after year. How much did we spend on that alternative school district Snyder set up a few years ago? We've spent this kind of money on things that didn't work. This would work. And I believe if you have all these folks who want to sort of prove that they're on the right side of this movement today by writing checks, write checks that might actually have a fairly quick impact.
I mean, so
massive numbers of kids to read, you're going to change the dynamics.
That's, of course, very true. I mean, teaching more kids to read on time, which is by 9 years old, according to the brain research that we now understand, is huge. But I also want to caution against the either or kind of approach to these things. It's not just teaching more people to read. My father knew how to read and went to serve in the Korean War as an airman first class in the Air Force. He came home to Mississippi that wouldn't let him sit at a lunch counter or wouldn't let him have the job that he was probably qualified for, and locked him out of the GI Bill, which did what? Which sent people to college for free and gave people access to low-interest loans to buy homes. That is the biggest wealth builder in our society. You have an entire generation of African-American GIs locked out of that. They could read. they were qualified to do more. You've got to remove the barriers on both ends, and the idea that somehow that discrimination doesn't play out today, the wealth that they were denied, the wealth building that they were denied by being locked out of the GI Bill, plays out today. Why do you see African American families with a fraction of the assets that white families have right now? Well, there's a big reason. So it's not just that we've got to teach people to read. We've got to go back and fix what got broken and address the gap that exists now, which owes 100% to legal and enforced discrimination.
And nobody's saying that that's the magic solution to teach people to read and all of a sudden racism goes away. But there are opportunities that black people that exist today, because we have, you know, it's not like we've been sitting still here since your father was a young man. I mean, we have changed employment laws and housing laws, and there are opportunities being created right in our own community today and laws to enforce those opportunities that can't be met because we have denied these children that basic skill of being able to read. And so as we create more opportunities, as we become aware of the need to be intentionally inclusive, you got to have people prepared to take those opportunities. And, you know, it's not enough to say we got 10 carpenter jobs over here if you can't read well enough to qualify for an apprenticeship. You know, it's not the ultimate solution, but it's a practical answer and a practical step we can take.
Stephen Henderson, Nolan Finley, a.k.a. Juan Williams, George Will, keep fighting, okay? Keep doing what you're doing and keep believing what you believe in. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Please join us next
time. Thanks for having us.
Until then, I'm Jack Rasulo. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.